Monsieur Poirot. Will you walk back with us to Stiles?
I should be enchanted, madame.
The weather had broken, and it felt more like autumn than early summer. Mary shivered and buttoned her coat close. As we went through the great door of Stiles, we came upon Dorcas. She was trembling and very pale.
They've arrested him, ma'am. They've arrested Mr. Cavendish.
They've arrested Lawrence?
No, sir, not Master Lawrence. Master John.
John?
I just can't believe it. After what you said about the strychnine bottle, I was certain it must be Lawrence. But John, my old friend John...
Every murderer is probably someone's old friend.
I must say, you might have given me a clue.
Perhaps I did not do so simply because he was your old friend. Did you never suspect him at all?
Never.
Did you not realize that if it was not her husband whom Mrs. Inglethorpe was quarreling with that afternoon, it must have been either Lawrence or John?
And it was John. Is that what you're saying?
Why else should Mary Cavendish have pretended not to remember the conversation at the inquest?
Do you think they'll find him guilty?
On the contrary, I think there is a chance he may be acquitted. But I cannot be certain. It is one thing to know that a man is guilty, but it is quite another matter to prove him so. I lack the last link in the chain, and I do not know where to look for it.
Did that mean Poirot believed John to be guilty or not?
It was 2 months before John was committed for trial at the Old Bailey, and during those weeks all my admiration and sympathy went out to Mary Cavendish. All thoughts of leaving John had been cast aside. She was determined to fight for him tooth and nail.
Yes, she is one of those women in whom adversity brings out the best. Her jealousy and her pride...
But her jealousy?
Have you not realized that she is a passionately jealous woman? But now she thinks only of her husband and of the terrible fate that is hanging over him.
Of course, he wouldn't tell me why she was jealous. It was another of those little mysteries Poirot persisted in keeping to himself. By the time the case came into court, I had been given a job at the War Office. Mary had taken a house in Kensington and invited Poirot and myself to stay with her. On September the 15th, John appeared in the dock to answer the charge of the willful murder of Emily Inglethorpe. Mr. Phillips opened for the Crown.
Rarely in the course of my career have I been confronted with a more ruthless or cold-blooded crime. The callous and deliberate poisoning, gentlemen of the jury, of a fond and trusting woman by a stepson to whom she had been more than a mother, who had supported him ever since his boyhood, a kind and generous benefactress to both the prisoner and his wife.
Mr. Phillips, a KC of the old school, began to build up a formidable and rather alarming case for the Crown.
I shall call witnesses to show that the prisoner, a profligate and spendthrift, had been at the end of his financial tether and, furthermore, had been carrying on an intrigue with the wife of a neighbouring farmer, a certain Mrs. Ricks.
No wonder poor Mary was so wretchedly unhappy.
This having come to Mrs. Inglethorpe's ears, she confronted the prisoner on the afternoon before her death, and a bitter quarrel ensued, part of which was most fortunately overheard. On the day previous to this, the prisoner had purchased strychnine at the village chemist's, wearing a disguise by which he hoped to throw suspicion upon another. The man he believed stood between himself and his stepmother's fortune, her husband, Alfred Inglethorpe. Fortunately, Mr. Inglethorpe had an unimpeachable alibi.
Provided by Mrs. Rakes, who had evidently been rather free with her favours.
On the afternoon of July the 17th, immediately after the quarrel with her stepson, Mrs. Inglethorpe made a new will. A fragment of this was found in the ashes of a bedroom fire the following morning, but it was undoubtedly drawn up in favour of her husband. This will had been almost certainly destroyed by the prisoner, but little did he know that the deceased had already drawn up a will in favour of her husband at the time of her engagement, which she had evidently forgotten about.
He got himself into rather a tangle over the various wills, and it was with considerable relief that he came to the end of his exposition and called to the stand his first witness, Inspector Japp.
Acting on information received, I searched the prisoner's room during his temporary absence from the house. In his chest of drawers, hidden under a pile of underwear, we found first a pair of gold-rimmed pince-nez, similar to those worn by Mr. Inglethorpe, and secondly, this file.
And you will see, gentlemen of the jury, that the file is labelled strychnine hydrochloride poison. And I believe you came across another piece of vital evidence, Inspector.
A piece of blotting paper in Mrs. Inglethorpe's checkbook. On being reversed in a mirror, one could discern the words, "Everything of which I die possessed, I leave to my beloved husband, Alfred Inge."
Which proves beyond question that the destroyed will had been in favour of the deceased's husband.
The counsel for the defence, Sir Ernest Heavyweather, was renowned for his bullying tactics, but it took him quite an effort to make any impression on the imperturbable Japp.
Tell me, Inspector, what day did you say it was that you searched the defendant's room?
Tuesday, the 24th of July.
Exactly a week after the tragedy. And you say that you found the pince-nez and the phial of strychnine in the chest of drawers. Was the drawer unlocked?
Yes, it was.
Does it not strike you as unlikely that a man who is supposed to have committed murder should keep such incriminating pieces of evidence in an unlocked drawer where anyone could find them?
He was probably in a hurry.
But it was a whole week after the crime. He would have had ample time to take them out of the house and destroy them.
Perhaps.
There is no perhaps about it. Would he or would he not have had time to take them out of the house and destroy them?
Yes.
Now, you say you found these things underneath a pile of underwear.
That is correct.
Heavy or light?
Heavy or light what?
Underclothing.
Heavy-ish.
Winter underclothing. Obviously the defendant would not be likely to go to that drawer.
Perhaps not.
Kindly answer my question. Would the defendant, in the hottest week of an exceptionally hot summer, be likely to go to a drawer containing winter underclothing, yes or no?
No.
In that case, is it not possible, Inspector, that the articles in question might have been put there by a third person, and that the defendant was totally unaware of their existence?
I should not think it likely.
But it is possible.
Yes.
That is all.
There followed what seemed to be an interminable wrangle over the parcel containing the black beard sent by the theatrical costumiers.
I believe, Miss Howard, that it was you who found this sheet of brown paper.
Yes, I did.
And where did you discover it?
On top of a wardrobe.
On top of the prisoner's wardrobe?
I believe so.
Did you not find it yourself?
Yes.
Then you must know where you found it.
Yes, it was on top of Mr. Cavendish's wardrobe.
The prosecution then further established that an assistant at the costumiers had sent a black beard to a Mr. L. Cavendish on receipt of his letter and a postal order. Sir Ernest made short work of him.
And where was the letter sent from?
From Stiles Court.
The same address to which you sent the parcel?
Yes.
How do you know?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
How do you know that the letter came to you from Stiles Court? Did you notice the postmark?
No, but...
Did you keep the envelope?
No, I...
So you did not notice the postmark nor retain any proof of it. And yet you affirm so confidently that it came from Stiles. It might, in fact, have been any postmark.
I suppose it might.
In fact, the letter might have been posted from anywhere. From Wales, for instance...
The significance of that last question only became apparent when Lawrence Cavendish took the stand, for at the date when the beard had been ordered, he had in fact been in Wales.
Do I understand that you deny having sent an order for a black beard on the 25th of June?
I do.
Then how do you account for the fact that it was ordered in your name and sent in your name to Stiles?
I cannot account for it.
In the event of anything happening to your brother John, Mr. Cavendish, who will inherit Stiles Court? Answer my question, if you please.
I suppose I should.
What do you mean, you suppose? Your brother has no children. You would inherit, wouldn't you?
Yes.
That's better. Now, on Tuesday, the 17th of July, you went, I believe, to visit the dispensary at the Red Cross Hospital in Tadminster.
Yes.
Did you, while you happened to be alone there for a few seconds, unlock the poison cupboard and examine some of the bottles?
I may have done so.
I put it to you that you did.
Yes.
Did you examine one bottle in particular?
No, I do not think so.
Be careful, Mr. Cavendish. I am referring to a phial of hydrochloride of strychnine.
No, I am sure I didn't.
Then how do you account for the fact that you left the unmistakable imprint of your fingers on it?
I suppose I must have taken up the bottle.
I suppose so, too. Did you abstract any of the contents of the bottle?
Certainly not.
Then why did you take it up?
I once studied as a doctor. Such things naturally interest me.
So, poisons naturally interest you, do they, Mr. Cavendish? But you waited until you were alone before gratifying this interest of yours?
Well, I
have nothing further to ask you, Mr. Cavendish.
He is a clever man, Sir Ernest.
Do you think he really believes Lawrence is guilty?
I do not think he believes anything. What he is trying to do is to create such confusion in the minds of the jury that they cannot be certain which of the brothers did it. He is trying to make out that there is as much evidence against Lawrence as there is against John. And I think he may well succeed.
But on the following day, when John took the stand, things began to go badly against him, particularly when he was asked why he did not come forward at the inquest to explain that it was he and not Alfred Inglethorpe who had been overheard quarrelling with his stepmother.
It never occurred to me that anyone could have mistaken my voice for that of Mr. Inglethorpe. I was told there had been a quarrel between him and my mother, and I simply did not think this had any connection with my own disagreement with her.
Not even when the housekeeper, Dorcas, repeated certain fragments of the conversation. Fragments which you must certainly have recognised.
I did not recognise them.
You must have a curiously selective memory, Mr. Cavendish.
The fact is that we were both angry and said more than we meant. I paid very little attention to my mother's actual words.
Mr. Phillips's incredulous sniff was a triumph of forensic art. But then he drew John onto far more dangerous ground. The question of his alibi for the time when the person disguised as Inglethorpe had purchased strychnine from the chemist's shop.
Your explanation is that you had been summoned to a place called Marston's Spinney by an anonymous letter threatening blackmail.
That is correct.
And is this the letter in question?
Yes, that is the letter.
You have produced this very opportunely, Mr. Cavendish. Tell me, is there nothing familiar about the handwriting?
Not that I know of.
Do you not see it bears a remarkable resemblance to your own handwriting, ineptly disguised?
No, I do not think so.
I put it to you that this is your own handwriting.
I deny that absolutely.
Is it not a fact that at the time you claim to have been at this solitary and unfrequented spot, you were, in fact, in the chemist's shop at Stiles St. Mary, disguised as Alfred Inglethorpe, and that you purchased strychnine, signing the register in his name?
That is utterly false.
Then I will leave the remarkable similarity between this letter, the forged signature in the chemist's poison book, and this specimen of your own handwriting to the consideration of the jury.
The case was adjourned until the following Monday. When they got back to the house, Poirot waved aside Mary's offer of a cup of tea and went straight upstairs. After a while, I followed him, and to my utter amazement, found him building a house of cards.
No, Hastings, I am not yet in my second childhood. Sherlock Holmes had his violin, I have my house of cards. It requires precision of the fingers, and with precision of the fingers comes precision of the brain. And never have I needed it more than now.
You've certainly got a remarkably steady hand. It's almost as if you were performing a conjuring trick.
I need a steady hand, mon ami. The slightest tremble would bring the whole house tumbling down.
I've only seen your hand shake once.
On an occasion when I was enraged, perhaps.
You certainly were. It was when you found that the dispatch box in Mrs. Inglethorpe's room had been forced open. You stood by the mantelpiece, fiddling with the spill vases, and your hand was shaking like a leaf.
Oh, mon Dieu!
What's the matter?
It is that I have an idea. A stupendous idea. And you, my friend, have given it to me.
Steady on.
Where can I find a garage?
Why do you want a garage?
I must return to Stiles at once.
I've had a telegram from Monsieur Poirot. He says we must all return immediately to Stiles. Everyone who was in the house at the time of the murder must be present.
What on earth for?
He wants to hold a little reunion, as he puts it. Even Inspector Japp has been invited.
Ours not to reason why, I suppose. There's no point in trying to argue with him when he's like this, and even less point in asking him what it's all about.
Now, Miss Howard, if you will kindly sit here.
Wherever you like. What's all this in aid of?
All will be revealed in good time. And you next to her, Mademoiselle Cynthia?
Certainly, Monsieur Poirot. This is all rather exciting.
And the good Dorcas will sit here. And Annie, will you please sit next to her? And if you would be so good as to sit here, Madame Cavendish.
Of course.
And you next to her, Monsieur Laurence.
Wherever you wish. I'll sit over by the window if it's all the same with you. Don't want to cramp your style.
But you must all be patient for a little while longer. We must delay the proceedings until Monsieur Inglethorpe arrives.
If that man comes into this room, I leave it.
Ah, but mademoiselle, it is most important that you remain here. You wish to see your dear friend, Madame Emily, revenged, do you not?
Well, if you put it like that.
A few minutes later, Alfred Inglethorpe arrived.
I understand you've organised a little get-together, monsieur.
Poirot ushered him to his seat and then turned to his little audience with the complacent air of a popular lecturer.
Mesdames, monsieur, as I am sure you all know, I was called in to investigate this case by Mr. John Cavendish. There were two questions to be resolved. How did Mrs. Inglethorpe die and why?
There's no mystery about that. She was poisoned by her husband for her money.
Monsieur Poirot, we know that you have a great reputation in Belgium as a detective, but we have been at the Old Bailey for a week being questioned and cross-questioned. Why do we have to go through it all again?
Because, Mr. Inglethorpe, we still have to arrive at the truth. Now, let us go back to the beginning.
If we must.
My first action on coming to Stiles was to examine the bedroom of the deceased. I found first a fragment of green material, secondly a stain on the carpet near the window, and thirdly an empty box which had contained bromide powders. To take the fragment of green material first, I found it caught in the bolt of the door communicating between the room and the adjoining one occupied by Mademoiselle Cynthia. It was a piece torn from a land worker's green armlet.
Ah, it must have been yours, Mary. You're the only one on the land.
And it could mean only that Mrs. Cavendish had entered Mrs. Inglethorpe's bedroom through the room of Mademoiselle Cynthia.
But the door was always kept bolted on the inside.
It would have been easy enough for Mrs. Cavendish to unbolt it earlier and then to slide the bolt back in the confusion around Mrs. Inglethorpe's deathbed. Now, at the inquest, Mrs. Cavendish, you declared, did you not, that you had heard from your room in the left wing the fall of the table by Mrs. Inglethorpe's bed?
Yes, I did.
I took the opportunity of testing that statement by stationing my friend Hastings outside the door of your room while I was showing Inspector Japp the scene of the crime.
And you proceeded to knock over a table by the bed. A clumsy accident, you said at the time.
So that's what it was about. And, of course, I didn't hear a thing.
This confirmed my suspicion that Mrs. Cavendish was not in her bedroom at the time of the tragedy, but was actually in Mrs. Inglethorpe's room.
I looked at Mary. Never had I seen her so proudly beautiful. It was inconceivable that she could have murdered Mrs. Inglethorpe. And then I remembered once again the gleam in her wonderful, tawny eyes when she had said that poison was a woman's weapon.
So, let us assume that Mrs. Cavendish is in her mother-in-law's room under the impression that she is sleeping peacefully. She is searching for something. Suddenly, Mrs. Inglethorpe wakes and is seized by an alarming paroxysm. She flings out her arm, overturning the bedside table, and then pulls desperately at the bell. Thoroughly alarmed, Mrs. Cavendish drops her candle, and the grease spills onto the carpet. She picks it up and retreats back to the room of Mademoiselle Cynthia, closing the door behind her.
You mean she didn't lift a finger to help poor Emily?
Patience, mademoiselle. Mrs. Cavendish hurries out into the passage, but already the footsteps of the servants are echoing along the gallery. Quickly, she goes back into the young girl's room and starts to shake her awake while the servants are battering on Mrs. Inglethorpe's door. When Mr. Lawrence discovers her there, she joins the others, and it occurs to no one that she has not arrived with the rest of the family. Am I right, madame?
Yes, Monsieur Poirot, you are quite right. You must understand that if I thought it would do my husband any good to reveal these facts, I would have done so.
It showed a callous disregard for my poor wife's suffering.
But what I don't understand is why I didn't wake up while all this was going on.
Because you had been drugged, mademoiselle.
Drugged?
And with this in mind, I examined all the coffee cups from which everyone had drunk that evening, remembering that it was Mrs. Cavendish who had given you your coffee. I took a sample from each cup. But I had made a serious miscalculation.
You hadn't realized that Dr. Baustein was there that evening, so there were 7 cups instead of 6.
So the missing cup could only be Cynthia's.
Oh, I know, because I'm the only one who doesn't take sugar.
But then my attention was caught by something you said, Annie.
Sir?
That there was a substance that looked like salt on Mrs. Inglethorpe's cocoa tray. Accordingly, I sent a sample of the cocoa to be analysed.
But Dr. Barstein had already done that, hadn't he?
Aha, but he had asked the analyst to look for traces of strychnine. I wanted to find out whether it contained a narcotic.
And, of course, it did.
You had administered a safe but effective narcotic both to Mademoiselle Cynthia's coffee and to Mrs. Inglethorpe's cocoa.
You can imagine my feelings when the poor soul died in agony and everyone said she'd been poisoned. It was the most awful hour of my life and I shall never forget it. Now I understand why you offered your services as a father confessor, Monsieur Poirot. I should have told you everything.
So now we are able to explain why the symptoms of strychnine poisoning took so long to make their appearance.
You mean that the drugged cocoa taken on top of the poisoned coffee would have delayed its effect.
Exactly, Monsieur Lawrence. But we come now to a little difficulty. Mrs. Inglethorpe never drank her cup of coffee. Do you remember the stain on the carpet of Mrs. Inglethorpe's room? It was still damp and smelled strongly of coffee. I realized what must have happened when I put my little case on the table near the window and it instantly tipped up. The same thing must have happened when Mrs. Inglethorpe put her coffee down on it. And so, she heated up her cocoa instead.
So she never drank any coffee at all?
No. And yet the strychnine must have been administered between 7 and 9 that evening.
So, how was it done?
Through a substance so suitable for disguising its taste that it is extraordinary that no one thought of it. Her mitten.
You mean the murderer introduced the strychnine into her tonic?
No, no. There was no need for that.
Her tonic already contained strychnine. I pointed that out at the inquest.
And it was perfectly harmless. But when a bromide is introduced into the mixture, the strychnine will be precipitated and collect at the bottom of the bottle, and the last dose will contain all of it and prove fatal.
So those bromide powders I made up for
were added to her medicine. But you were not to know that they were to be used in that way.
No. I had no idea they could have that effect.
And the person who habitually poured out Mrs. Inglethorpe's medicine was always careful not to shake the bottle, so as not to disturb the deadly sediment at the bottom.
Quite ingenious, really, when you think about it. But please go on, Monsieur Poirot.
Throughout the case, there have been indications that the tragedy was intended to take place on the Monday evening. Mrs. Inglethorpe's bell wire had been severed. Mademoiselle Cynthia was spending the night with friends.
So she would have been quite alone in her room in the right wing, completely cut off from everyone. She would have died long before medical help could have reached her.
And there would have been no one to observe the unmistakable effects of the strychnine poisoning.
Exactly. But on that Monday night, in her hurry to be on time for the concert, Mrs. Inglethorpe forgot to take her medicine.
Oh, she didn't forget it, sir. I told her she ought to take it, but she said it'd do her no harm to go without it for once.
And alas, she was right. For by not taking that last fatal dose until the following evening, she prolonged her life for another 24 hours, and it is to the events of those 24 hours that I shall now turn.
Is this really necessary? None of it's getting us anywhere.
It is necessary, Mr. Inglethorpe, and as you will see, it is getting us somewhere. Let us now consider the matter of the will.
Was it the will you were looking for in Emily's room, Mary? Did you destroy it?
No, I wasn't looking for the will, Lawrence. And the only person who could have destroyed it was Mrs. Inglethorpe herself.
That's ridiculous. I thought she was supposed to have made it on the afternoon before her death. You can't tell me she destroyed it on the same day.
Nevertheless, mademoiselle, that is what happened. How else can you account for the fact that on one of the hottest days of the year, Mrs. Inglethorpe ordered a fire to be lit in her room?
Stands out like a sore thumb, really.
Mrs. Inglethorpe would have ordered a fire only because she wanted to destroy something so that no one would ever see it and could think of no other way. In fact, Hastings and I found a charred fragment of it in the ashes of her fireplace.
But why should she destroy a will she'd only just made?
That is what I asked myself. I thought at first it was the consequence of the quarrel she had had earlier that afternoon, but now I realize I was wrong. Can you remind us, Dorcas, of what you overheard your mistress say?
She said, "You need not think that any fear of publicity, of scandal between husband and wife will deter me."
Those words were addressed not to Mr. Inglethorpe, as you supposed, but to her stepson, John Cavendish. And now, will you tell us what she said to you an hour later?
I've had a great shock, she said to me. I don't know what to do. Scandal between a husband and wife is a terrible thing, Dorcas. And she was holding a piece of paper in her hand.
But this second scandal she spoke of was not the same as the scandal with which she had confronted John Cavendish earlier that afternoon. Then she had been speaking of his liaison with Mrs. Raikes, but now she was referring to a scandal which concerned herself. What did she do then?
She ordered me to light the fire in her room.
So, let us reconstruct what happened. At 4 o'clock, Mrs. Inglethorpe quarrels with her stepson and threatens to tell his wife about the affair with Mrs. Raikes. I believe you overheard the greater part of that conversation, madame.
Yes, I did. And you can understand why I chose to say nothing about it.
Immediately afterwards, Mrs. Inglethorpe makes a new will in favour of her husband, cutting out John Cavendish. But then, at 5, she tells Dorcas to light a fire so that she can destroy the will she has just made.
So what happened in between, do you reckon?
I believe that Mrs. Inglethorpe had been anxious to send the new will off to her lawyers immediately, but she had no stamps. In the corner of her room stood her husband's desk. It was locked, but she had a key and opened it. In searching for the stamps, she came across a sheet of paper that she was never meant to see. This was the paper that Dorcas saw her holding in her hand shortly afterwards, and this, I believe, Mrs. Cavendish, was what you were searching for in her room on the night of her death?
I was certain that it was a letter from Mrs. Rakes to my husband. Mrs. Inglethorpe told me that it had nothing to do with him, but I didn't believe her.
So, what was this paper?
It was a letter written in haste by the murderer to his accomplice when he realized that Mrs. Inglethorpe's death would take place 24 hours later than they had planned. I will read it to you. Dearest Evelyn, you will be anxious about hearing nothing. It is all right, only it will be tonight instead of last night. There's a good time coming once the old woman is dead and out of the way. No one can possibly bring the crime home to me. That idea of yours about the bromide was a stroke of genius, but we must be careful. One false step... Here the letter breaks off, but there is...
You devil! How did you get hold of it?
I don't think that need concern us now, Mr. Inglethorpe. There's a Black Maria outside. We don't want to keep it waiting, do we? You too, Miss Howard.
The moment I set eyes on you, I knew you were going to be trouble, you little egg-shaped monster!
So did you really suspect Inglethorpe from the word go, Monsieur Poirot?
Oh, yes. There was no getting away from the fact that whoever stood to gain from his wife's death, he would benefit the most. I had no idea how the crime had been committed, but from what I knew of Mr. Inglethorpe, it would be very difficult to connect him with it. And then, when I began to investigate the Mrs. Rakes affair, my suspicions became a certainty.
How do you mean?
If he had been seriously involved with her, his stubborn silence at the inquest would have been perfectly comprehensible. But when I discovered that it was known all over the village that it was John Cavendish who was enamoured of the pretty lady, Inglethorpe's behaviour took on a very different meaning. It was nonsense to pretend that he was afraid of a scandal, and so I was forced to the conclusion that by constantly refusing to say where he had been when the strychnine was purchased, he was doing his utmost to get himself arrested. And from that moment, I was equally determined that he should not be.
But why on earth should he want to be arrested?
Because we have a very curious law in this country that if a man is once acquitted of a crime... he can never be tried again for the same offence. And if it hadn't been for Monsieur Poirot, I should have fallen headlong into the trap. I would have arrested Inglethorpe, he would have revealed his irreproachable alibi, and he would have been safe for life.
But even so, he was actually seeing Mrs. Rakes.
Oh, yes, yes, they took harmless little walks together along the lanes at times when Inglethorpe particularly wanted to establish an alibi for himself.
Like the time he was supposed to have bought the strychnine from the chemist's shop.
But I still don't see how he managed that. I mean, how could he be in two places at once?
Oh, is it possible? My poor friend, have you not realized it was Miss Howard who went to the chemist's shop?
Miss Howard? In that black beard?
Who else? She is of a similar height, her voice is rather manly, and remember that she and Inglethorpe are cousins, and that there is a distinct resemblance between them.
And do you think the use of the bromide really was her idea?
I am inclined to think she was the mastermind in the whole affair, and had been planning Mrs. Inglethorpe's murder from the moment she first arrived at Stiles. I fancy that she and Inglethorpe were already passionately involved with one another.
So, all she had to do was to introduce him into the household at Stiles and let him work his wicked will on Mrs. Inglethorpe.
Poor Emily. She saw herself as such a forceful character, but underneath it all she was lonely and terribly gullible.
But would Evelyn Howard really have the medical know-how to set up the poisoning?
Oh, no special knowledge was needed, my friend. All that she had to know, she could have picked up from one of Lawrence Cavendish's medical textbooks. She knew that Mrs. Inglethorpe had a box of bromide powders and would occasionally take one at night. What could be easier than to dissolve one of them in her bottle of medicine?
And by the time Mrs. Inglethorpe had swallowed the last fatal dose, Miss Howard would have engineered her silly quarrel with her and left the house.
Ah, yes, it was a clever idea, and if they had left it alone, the murder would probably never have been linked to them.
What do you mean, if they left it alone?
They wanted a scapegoat, and decided to throw suspicion on John Cavendish. That is the sole reason for Evelyn Howard putting on the black beard and obtaining the strychnine.
So that she could sign Inglethorpe's name in John's handwriting?
I presume it must also have been Miss Howard who wrote the note telling Cavendish to go to Martin Spinney, or wherever it was.
And again, she wrote it in his handwriting.
But then all their careful planning was thrown into confusion because Mrs. Inglethorpe did not take her medicine on the night they had calculated she would.
Even so, it was pretty stupid of Inglethorpe to write that letter.
I think his wife actually came into the room while he was writing it. He slipped it into his desk and went off for a walk.
And it was only by the merest chance she happened to find it. Poor Emily. It must have been a terrible shock for her.
I suppose Inglethorpe couldn't have realised it was missing until after her death. But how on earth did he know where she'd put it?
She always kept personal and important documents in her dispatch case. Just imagine the feelings of Mr. Inglethorpe the following morning when he hears that John Cavendish and Mr. Wells are to examine the contents of the case and that I have the key. He panics and breaks it open. Every moment is vital. So what do you think he does with the letter?
I am the foggiest.
Do not forget, the fire is not lit, so he cannot burn it. Instead, he tears it. He tears it into long, thin strips, rolls them into spills, and puts them among the others in the jars on the mantelpiece.
Oh, however did you work that out?
So you, mon ami.
Me?
Yes, you told me that my hands were shaking after I discovered that Mrs. Inglethorpe's dispatch case had been broken into and that I was straightening the spill jars on the mantelpiece. But then, you see, I remembered that I had already straightened them earlier that morning. So, someone else must have moved them.
And that is why you rushed back to Stiles.
So you see, Captain Hastings, we owe it all to you. But I'd better be off. I must see these precious cousins off to their respective jails. Thank you, Monsieur Poirot. Once again, you've saved me from making an ass of myself.
I do think you might have given me a few hints instead of leading me up the garden path like that.
Oh, I did nothing of the kind, mon ami. At most, I permitted you to deceive yourself.
But why?
Because you have a nature so honest and a countenance so transparent that if I told you my ideas the very first time you looked upon Alfred Inglethorpe, that astute gentleman would, in your charming English phrase, have smelt a rat.
I think I have more diplomacy than you give me credit for.
Oh, no, do not enrage yourself, my friend. Your help has been most invaluable. It is but your beautiful nature that gave me pause.
I still think you might have given me a few clues. As it was, you left me to flounder about on my own, suspecting practically everybody. Bauerstein, Mary Cavendish, Lawrence, well, particularly Lawrence. After all, he was behaving very strangely.
You realize, of course, what was behind all that.
No.
Well, you did not see that he believed Mademoiselle Cynthia to be guilty of the crime?
But that's ridiculous.
No, not in the least. The possibility was in my mind when I asked Mr. Wells about the provisions of the will. And it was Mademoiselle Cynthia who made up the bromide powders. Shall I tell you what made Monsieur Laurence turn so pale when he first entered his dying stepmother's room?
What?
He saw that the door into Mademoiselle Cynthia's room was unbolted.
But he saw it was bolted.
Exactly. And that confirmed my suspicion that it was not. He could not have realized that Mary Cavendish had opened it. He believed that Cynthia had done so, and he was determined to shield her.
But why?
Because he is in love with her.
Oh, no, Poirot, you're quite wrong there. I know for a fact that he doesn't care for her at all.
Who told you that?
Cynthia herself.
They are like that, les femmes. Why else did he grind Mrs. Inglethorpe's coffee cup into the floor with his heel? Because he suspected that Mademoiselle Cynthia may have had something to do with the poisoning, and he was determined there should be no chance of analysing its contents.
Was that why he kept on insisting that his stepmother had died from natural causes?
Of course. He hoped, as a trained doctor, his opinion might carry some weight.
And what about the extra coffee cup you wanted him to find?
I was fairly certain that Mary Cavendish had hidden it to conceal the fact she had put a sleeping draught into Mademoiselle Cynthia's coffee. If I could prove that, then the young lady would be in the clear.
Well, I'm glad it's all ended happily. Even John and Mary seem to be reconciled.
And they have me to thank for that.
You?
What, do you not realize it was the trial that brought them together again? I was convinced that John Cavendish loved his wife and she him, but they had drifted far apart. You remember the day of John Cavendish's arrest, when you found me deliberating over a major decision?
Yes, but I had no idea what it was all about.
I was trying to decide whether or not I should clear John Cavendish at once.
You mean you could have saved him from being brought to trial at all?
Oh, yes, my friend. But in the end, I decided in favor of a woman's happiness. Nothing but the great danger through which they have passed could have brought these two proud souls together again.
I looked at him with silent amazement, the colossal cheek of the man. Who but Poirot would have thought a trial for murder would restore conjugal happiness?
One moment, Hastings. Do you see over there by the fountain?
Lawrence and Cynthia. Good Lord, she's kissing him. And he's kissing her.
So perhaps he does not dislike her quite as much as she supposed.
They make a pretty pair, don't they? Thank goodness they've realised at last what was obvious to the rest of us.
It wasn't obvious to me.
I'm going back to London. Inspector Japp says John will be set free tomorrow morning. Thank you, Monsieur Poirot. Without you, he would be facing the gallows.
I am happy to have been of service, madam.
And thank you, Captain Hastings. You helped me through my darkest hour. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Ah, mon pauvre ami. You were in love with both of them, were you not?
Yes, they were two delightful women.
Console yourself, mon cher Hastings. One day this terrible war will be over, and we will hunt together again. And then, who knows what the future will bring.
In Agatha Christie's The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, Hercule Poirot was played by John Moffat, Captain Hastings, Simon Williams. Detective Inspector Japp, Philip Jackson. Emily Inglethorpe, Jill Balkan. Alfred Inglethorpe, Hugh Dixon. Evelyn Howard, Nicola McAuliffe. John Cavendish, Sean Arnold. Mary Cavendish, Susan Jameson. Lawrence Cavendish, Nicholas Bolton. Cynthia Murdoch, Annabel Dowler. Dorcas, Hilda Schroeder. Dr. Bauerstein, Robert Portal. Mr. Wells, Richard Sims. The Coroner, Peter Howell. Mr. Mace, Harry Myers. Inspector Summerhayes, Don McCorkindale, Mr. Phillips, Johan Meredith, Sir Ernest Heavyweather, Michael Mears, the costumier's assistant, Richard Katz. Other parts were played by members of the cast. The music was composed by Tom Smale. The Mysterious Affair at Stiles was dramatized by Michael Bakewell and directed by Enid Williams. Present John Moffat as Hercule Poirot and Simon Williams as Captain Hastings in Agatha Christie's Peril at End House.
You know, Poirot, I don't think there's anywhere on the south coast as attractive as St. Lou. No wonder they call it the Queen of Watering Places. It's just like being on the Riviera. Mind you, I always think that Cornwall is every bit as fascinating as the south of France.
Yeah, so it said on our menu in the restaurant car yesterday, Hastings.
Oh, did it?
It is hardly a very original observation.
We were sitting on one of the terraces of the majestic hotel. Below us lay the gardens, looking almost tropical with their palm trees. The sea was a deep and lovely blue, and the sun was shining with all the single-hearted fervour an August sun should, but in England so rarely does. Only the speedboats roaring across the bay and the buzzing of the marauding wasps disturbed a scene of perfect peace.
Tell me, Hastings, is there anything of interest in your paper?
Well, nothing much to speak of. Trouble of some sort in China, a swindle in the city, and an outbreak of parrot disease.
How very curious.
Still no news of Captain Seaton.
Well, the man who was flying around the world in that, how is he called?
A seaplane.
No. There is another word.
An amphibian.
That is it.
The albatross. That's what his plane is called. Too bad if the fellow's gone west. But he could always have come down by one of the more remote Pacific islands.
Let us trust not one inhabited by cannibals.
He must be a pretty plucky chap. That sort of courage makes one feel it's a great thing to be an Englishman.
Mm. It consoles for the defeats at Wimbledon.
Oh, I didn't
know.
Mean...
No, me, I am not an amphibian like the machine of the unfortunate Captain Seaton. I prefer to live in one element, the earth, which is good enough for me.
Are you never tempted to renew your detective activities, this passive life?
Suits me admirably. To sit in the sun, what could be more charming? To step from your pedestal at the zenith of your fame, what could be a grander gesture? To hear people say, that is Hercule Poirot. Mm-hmm. There never was anyone like him. There never will be. I am satisfied. I ask no more. Hercule Poirot has solved his last case.
Aren't you afraid of tempting the gods?
Impossible, mon ami, that anything should shake the will of Hercule Poirot.
Impossible, Poirot?
Ah, you're right, my friend. One should not use such a word. I do not say that if a bullet should strike the wall by my head, I should not investigate the matter. One is human after all.
What was that?
Only a pebble, mon ami. Yes. One is human, one is the sleeping dog, but the sleeping dog can be roused. Let us descend into the garden.
He set off ahead of me down the steps, which led from the terrace to the rose garden, and as he did so, a girl came hurrying up towards us.
Oh!
What about Poirot? Are you all right?
Oh, it aches my ankle.
Let me help you up.
Here, Poirot, take my arm.
Oh, a thousand pardons.
Just take it slowly.
Oh, mademoiselle, you are most kind. I regret exceedingly. My foot, he pains me considerably.
Can you stand on it?
It is the turned ankle, that is all. In a few minutes, all will be well, but... If you could help me over to that chair, Hastings.
Of course.
You and mademoiselle between you, if she will be so very kind.
Just hold on to me.
There you are.
Oh, thank you.
I think I'd better go and get a doctor.
No. That is not necessary. The ankle turned, that is all. But in a little minute, it will have been forgotten. Mademoiselle, I thank you a thousand times. Please, sit down, I beg you.
I really think you ought to get it seen to.
Oh, mademoiselle, I assure you, it is a bagatelle. In the pleasure of your society, the pain passes already.
I'm very flattered.
It was very fortunate that you happened to be passing, mademoiselle. You are staying at the hotel?
Oh, no. I'm meeting some friends in the lounge for cocktails. I live at End House.
End House?
Over there, out on the point.
Rather an eerie-looking place.
Like something out of Edgar Poe. The House of Usher, perhaps.
Anyway, I love it. But the place is going to rack and ruin.
You are the last of an old family, mademoiselle?
Oh, we're nothing very important. But there have been Buckleys there for 200 or 300 years. My brother died 3 years ago, so I'm the last of the family.
Oh, that is sad. You live there alone?
I wouldn't really put it like that. I'm away a good deal, and when I'm home, there's usually a cheery mob coming and going.
That is so modern.
I was picturing you in a dark, mysterious mansion haunted by a family curse.
What a picturesque imagination you have. The house isn't haunted. Or if it is, the ghost must be a very kind, protective one. I've had 3 escapes from sudden death in as many days, so I must bear a charmed life.
Escapes from death?
How very interesting.
Oh, they weren't very exciting. Just accidents. Damn these wasps. There must be a nest of them somewhere.
You have been stung, yes?
No, but I hate it when they come right past your face. One of them just missed me only a few minutes ago. Seem to be all over the place today.
The bee in the bonnet, perhaps. And that is a particularly elegant hat you are wearing.
Oh, do you think so?
No, I did not mean you to take it off.
Her dark hair was ruffled and gave her an elfin look. In fact, there was something elfin about her altogether. The small, vivid face, the enormous dark blue eyes, something haunting and arresting. Was it a hint of recklessness? And there were dark shadows under her eyes.
And now I really must be going. They'll be wondering where I've got to.
Nick! Nick!
What did I tell you?
So that's where you've been hiding. Fred is absolutely desperate for a drink.
I was just coming. This is Commander Challenger.
Of the British Navy, I presume. Oh, I have a great regard for the British Navy.
Really?
Come on, George. Let's go and join Freddie and Jim. I hope the ankle will be all right, monsieur. Goodbye.
Ah, yes. I am sure it will. Goodbye, mademoiselle.
Goodbye, Miss Buckley.
So, that is one of mademoiselle's friends, one of her cheery crowd. Oh, but she has left her hat behind. Has the commander a tendresse for her, do you think?
My dear Poirot, how can I possibly tell? Give me that hat, I'll take it to her.
Oh, not yet, no. Some amuse.
Really, Poirot?
I grow old and childish, but I am not so completely imbecile as you think. We will return the hat later to End House, and thus gain another opportunity of meeting the charming Miss Nick.
Poirot, I believe you've fallen in love.
She is a pretty girl, is she not?
Why are you so interested in her?
No, you are under a misapprehension, my friend. I may be interested in the lady, it is true, but I am much more interested in her hat.
In her hat?
You see the reason for my interest?
Perfectly plain, fawn felt, with a wide brim.
No, I did not ask you to describe the hat. Regard more closely, my dear old imbecile. It is not necessary to use the little grey cells. The eyes will do.
Oh, I see what you mean. There's a hole in the brim.
Did you observe the way mademoiselle flinched when that creature flew past? The bee in the bonnet, the hole in the brim.
But a wasp couldn't make a hole like that.
Oh, what acumen. No, Hastings, it could not. But a bullet could.
A bullet?
May we? A bullet like this one.
Where did you get hold of that?
A spent bullet. It was that which fell at our feet when we were talking together on the terrace.
And I thought it was just a pebble. Was that why you went through that pantomime about twisting your ankle?
Ah-ha-ha, you see at last. I wish to make the acquaintance of Mademoiselle Nick because I believe that it was at her that the bullet was fired. 1 inch of a difference, and the hole would not have been through the hat, but through the head.
Good Lord!
But he made a grave mistake, that would-be murderer, when he shot at his victim within a dozen yards of Hercule Poirot. And what was it that Mademoiselle herself said?
That she'd had 3 escapes from sudden death in as many days.
Exactly, my friend. And now there has been a 4th. The peril is very close at hand.
Poirot, I've been thinking.
An admirable exercise, mon ami. Continue it.
That shot must have been fired quite close to us. And yet the funny thing is that we didn't hear it. It is rather odd.
No, it is not at all odd. All this morning, speedboats have been making trips round the bay. Ma foi, you could fire a machine gun almost and never notice it when one of those abominations goes pop, pop, popping out to sea. here comes Mademoiselle Nick and more of her cheery crowd. Evidently, they are going to take lunch here, and therefore, when a suitable opportunity presents itself, I must return the hat.
For the remainder of our meal, my friend was silent and unusually distant, keeping his eye entirely on Miss Buckley and her friends. Challenger was sitting next to her, and there was a tall, fair, rather exquisite young man with a supercilious manner and a tired drawl. The woman sitting beside him was an unusual type. A weary Madonna describes her best. Her face was dead white and emaciated, yet curiously attractive. Her eyes were light grey with very large pupils. At the end of the meal, the two men left to inspect a very ostentatious, gleaming red car, which belonged to the languid young man, and the two women went to take coffee in the lounge.
Now is our opportunity to have a little word with Mademoiselle Nick. I will see if I can arrange a meeting at End House where we can be away from the rest of them.
He marched into the lounge with an almost military determination and drew Miss Buckley to one side.
Mademoiselle, may I crave one little word with you?
I was left, feeling rather ill at ease, not knowing whether to strike up a conversation with Miss Buckley's companion or not. She was staring at me with a look of curious detachment.
Oh, why don't you sit down until your friend has finished with Nick?
Thank you. Miss Buckley very kindly came to the rescue of my friend when he twisted his ankle this morning.
So Nick told me. There doesn't seem to be much wrong with his ankle now, does there?
Just a momentary sprain.
Well, at least I'm glad to hear that Nick didn't invent the whole thing. She's the most heaven-sent little liar that ever existed, you know.
Is that so?
She's one of my oldest friends, but I always think loyalty's a tiresome virtue, don't you? Nick told us all a marvellous story about something going wrong with the brakes of her car. But Jim Lazarus, he was with us just now, said there was nothing in it at all. And he's by way of being quite expert about cars.
Fortunately, I was spared any further embarrassing disclosures about her friend by the return of Poirot, who gave a quick bow to the listless Madonna and drew me hastily away to the privacy of his sitting room.
It is all arranged, my friend. We are to call on Mademoiselle at End House at 6:30.
How did you manage it?
Well, she was a little unwilling, naturally. I could see the thoughts passing through her mind. Who is he, this little man? Is he the bounder? The moving picture director? If she could have refused, she would. But it is difficult. Asked like that on the spur of the moment, it is easier to consent.
It still seems perfectly incredible to me to take a pot shot at somebody in a hotel garden. Only a madman would do such a thing.
I disagree with you. Given one condition, it would be quite a reasonably safe affair. To begin with, the garden is deserted and there is plenty of cover. Trees, palms, flowering shrubs. Anyone could hide and be unobserved while waiting for Mademoiselle to come that way.
But how could he be certain that she would?
Because Mademoiselle Nick is one of those people who is always late and she would take the shortcut. The way through the hotel garden is the most direct route from End House.
All the same, the risk was enormous. He might have been seen, and you can't make the shooting seem like an accident.
Not like an accident, no.
What do you mean by that?
Nothing. A little idea. Leaving it aside for the moment, there is, as I said just now, the essential condition.
And what is that?
Surely you can tell me, Hastings.
I wouldn't like to deprive you of the pleasure of being clever at my expense.
Oh, the sarcasm, the irony. Well, my friend, what leaps to the eye is this. The motive for the attempt to kill Mademoiselle Nick cannot be obvious. If it were, then, as you say, the risk would be too great. People would be bound to say, I wonder where so-and-so was when the shot was fired. No, the identity of our would-be killer cannot be obvious. That is what disturbs me. I want to find out about these so-called accidents that Mademoiselle dismisses so lightly.
From the outside, End House was very large and very dreary-looking and was clearly in a bad state of repair.
Now, how about a cocktail?
Oh, yes.
I'm told it's one of the few things I do really well.
The inside of the house could not have been a greater contrast. The drawing room was full of sunshine and the light of the sea. The curtains were of faded brocade, but the covers were new and gay, and the cushions were positively hectic.
I'm simply devoured with curiosity. Am I the long-lost heroine you've been seeking for your next film? Well, you were so solemn at lunchtime. I feel it can't be anything else. Here, try this.
Thank you.
Thank you, mademoiselle.
Mm. Excellent.
Well?
To your good health, mademoiselle. To your continued good health.
Is there something the matter?
Yes, mademoiselle. This. You know what it is?
Yes, of course I do. It's a bullet.
It was not a wasp that flew past your face in the garden this morning. It was this bullet.
Oh, you mean that some idiot was firing off bullets in the hotel garden?
It would seem so.
I never heard a gun go off.
I want to know about these other so-called accidents that you mentioned. I want to be sure that that was what they were.
But what else could they be?
Now leave me to be the judge of that, mademoiselle.
What if someone is attempting your life?
Oh, but who on earth would want to kill me? I'm not the beautiful young heiress. I only wish I were worth killing. But I'm afraid there isn't a hope.
Will you tell me about these accidents, mademoiselle?
Of course. There's really nothing to it. I'm sorry I even mentioned them. There's a heavy picture that hangs over my bed. It fell down in the night. As luck would have it, I happened to hear a door banging somewhere in the house, and I went down to shut it. Otherwise, it would probably have bashed my head in.
And what about accident number two?
Oh, that's even more feeble. There's a scrambly cliff path down to the sea, which I use most days when I go to bathe. A boulder got dislodged somehow and came roaring down, just missing me. It gave me the fright of my life.
I'm sure it must have done.
The third thing was quite different. Something went wrong with the brakes of my car. I don't quite know what. The garage man did explain, but I couldn't really follow it. If I'd gone down the hill towards the town, there would have been a devil of a smash. But owing to my always leaving something behind, I turned back and only ran into the laurel hedge.
And you can't say what the actual trouble was?
If you really want to know, you can ask them at Mott's garage. I think what it boiled down to was that something had come loose or been unscrewed.
Where do you keep your car, mademoiselle?
In the shed, round the other side of the house.
So anyone could tamper with the car without being noticed?
Well, yes, I suppose so. Yeah. Oh, but it's so silly.
No, mademoiselle, she's not silly. I tell you, you are in grave danger. Do you know who I am?
I'm afraid I don't. Should I?
I am Hercule Poirot.
Oh, yes.
You are not at ease. That means, I suppose, that you have not read my books.
Well, no. Not all of them, but I know the name, of course.
Mademoiselle, you are a polite little liar. I forgot. You are only a child. You would not have heard. So quickly does fame pass. My friend will tell you.
Monsieur Poirot was a great detective.
Oh, is that all you can find to say? Tell mademoiselle that I am a detective unsurpassed, the greatest that ever lived.
But that's no longer necessary. You've told her yourself.
Ah, yes, but one should not have to sing one's own praises.
There's no point in keeping a dog and having to bark oneself. Who is the dog, by the way?
My name's Hastings.
Oh, 1066 and all that. Oh, but seriously, it's very kind of you and all that. But it's nothing more than a series of silly accidents.
You are as obstinate as the devil.
Well, that's where I get my name from. My grandfather was supposed to have sold his soul to the devil. Everyone round here called him Old Nick. Oh, he was a wicked old man, but great fun. I adored him. I went everywhere with him. And so they called us Old Nick and Young Nick. My real name is Magdala.
What a very unusual name.
Yes, it's a kind of family one. There have been lots of Magdalas in the Buckley family. There's one on the wall over there.
Oh, and very beautiful she is, too.
And the portrait over the mantelpiece, is that your grandfather, mademoiselle?
Yes, that's Old Nick. Quite striking, isn't it? Well, Jimmy Lazarus wanted to buy it. He offered me £50 for it, but I wouldn't sell. I've got a great affection for Old Nick. There was a saying round here that everything he touched turned to gold. but he was a gambler and soon ran through it all. When he died, he left hardly anything beside the house and the land.
Listen to me, mademoiselle, and I implore you to be serious. Your life is in great danger. Today somebody shot at you with a Mauser pistol.
A Mauser?
Yes. Why do you ask? Do you know of anyone who has a Mauser pistol?
I've got one myself.
You have?
Yes, it was my father's. He brought it back from the war, and it's been knocking around the house ever since. I saw it only the other day in the drawer of the bureau.
Perhaps you should check that it is still there.
Anything to keep the great detective happy. That's funny. I could have sworn I saw it in here. I must have dreamt it. No, it's not here. I expect it's somewhere around.
You remember, Hastings, that I told you I had a little idea? Well, it was correct. Supposing Mademoiselle had been found shot, lying in the hotel garden, and beside her hand, just fallen from it, would have been found her own pistol. There would be suggestions, no doubt, of worry, of sleeplessness.
Well, that's true enough. Everybody's been telling me I've been looking nervy lately.
They would have brought in a verdict of suicide. Mademoiselle's fingerprints on the pistol and nobody else's.
Oh, terribly amusing.
N'est-ce pas? But you understand, mademoiselle, there must be no more of this. Four accidents, yes, but the fifth time may be different.
Bring out your rubber-tired hearses.
But we are here, my friend and I, to prevent all that.
Yes, we'll look after you, Miss Buckley.
Oh, how frightfully nice of you.
And so it is time for me to begin to act as the conventional detective and to ask the conventional questions. Who profits by your death, mademoiselle?
Oh, I can't imagine. That's why it all seems such nonsense. All I have in the world is this beastly old barn of a house. And it's mortgaged up to the hilt. The roof leaks, and there can't be a diamond mine or anything exciting like that hidden in the cliff.
It is mortgaged, you say?
Yes, I had no alternative. You see, there were two lots of death duties on top of one another. First, my grandfather died, just 6 years ago, and then my brother. That just about put the lid on the financial position.
And your father?
He was invalided home from the war, then got pneumonia and died in 1919.
And after you, mademoiselle, who is your nearest relative?
My cousin, Charles Weiss. He's a solicitor in St. Lou. Quite good and worthy, but very dull.
Does he manage your affairs for you?
I suppose you could say that, not that I really any to manage. He fixed up the mortgage for me and made me let the lodge.
The lodge? And to whom is it let?
To some Australians. Croft, their name is. Too terribly friendly for words. Always bringing me sticks of celery and peas and that sort of thing. Mrs. Croft's a cripple and lies on the sofa all day. But they pay the rent and that's what matters.
And now for your friends, mademoiselle, the ones with whom you were lunching today, for instance.
Well, Freddy Rice, Frederica, is practically my greatest friend. Oh, she's had a rotten life, married to the most frightful beast, drink and drugs and all that. She left him a couple of years ago. Since then, she's just drifted about. Oh, I wish to goodness she'd marry Jimmy Lazarus.
Is that the art dealer in Bond Street?
Yes, Jim's the only son. Rolling in money. He's devoted to Freddy and they go everywhere together.
And where is Mrs. Rice's husband?
Oh, God knows. He's dropped out of everything. It makes it horribly awkward for Freddy. You can't divorce a man when you don't know where he is.
And what about the good Commander Challenger?
I've known George for about 5 years. It seems like all my life. He's a good soul, George.
He wants you to marry him, hmm?
He does mention it now and again in the small hours of the morning or after the second glass of port.
But you won't accept him.
What would be the use of George and I marrying one another? We've neither of us got a bean. And he must be 40 if he's a day.
In fact, he has one foot in the grave. And you are young and beautiful, mademoiselle, and the sun shines, and there is life and love ahead of you, and I am determined that you shall live to enjoy them. Tell me, have you a friend you can trust?
Well, there's Freddy.
No, other than Mrs. Rice.
Why do you want to know?
Because I want you to have a friend to stay with you. Immediately.
Well, there's Maggie, I suppose. I could get hold of her, I expect.
Who's Maggie?
Maggie Buckley, one of my Yorkshire cousins. I usually have her to stay here sometime or other in the summer. Oh, she's not much fun, though. Her father's a clergyman, and she's one of those painfully pure girls, with the kind of hair that has just become fashionable by accident.
She will do admirably.
I certainly don't know who else I could get hold of at this time of year. But if it isn't the choir boys' outing or the mother's bean feast, she'll come all right. I'll wire her to come on Monday.
Why not tomorrow?
On Sunday trains and all the way from Yorkshire? She'll think I'm dying if I suggest that. No, I'll say Monday.
Very well. Now tell me, mademoiselle, have you ever made a will?
Yes, about 6 months ago before my op.
Qu'est-ce que vous dites? Your op?
My appendix operation.
Uh-huh.
Someone said I ought to make a will, so I did.
And what were the terms of the will?
I left Endhurst to Charles Vice. Mm-hmm. I hadn't much else to leave, but what there was I bequeathed to Freddy.
To Mrs. Rice?
Yes. Mm. I have a nasty feeling that the liabilities would probably exceed the assets.
So, now we will take our leave. But I must warn you to be careful.
Of what?
Yes, you are right. In which direction to be careful? But do not fear, mademoiselle. In a little while I shall have discovered the truth.
And until then I should beware of bombs and boulders, falling pictures and arrows dipped in the secret poison of South American Indians.
Hmm. You make a joke of everything, do you not? But four attempts on your life is no laughing matter. Murder is not to be mocked, mademoiselle. You see, Hastings, where the path leads down the cliff to the sea, that is where the boulder so narrowly missed Mademoiselle Nick. She had a very fortunate escape.
Poirot, there is something I think I should tell you.
Then tell me.
At lunchtime in the hotel, while you were talking to Miss Buckley, I had a little chat with her friend, Mrs. Rice, or at least she did most of the talking.
And what did she talk about?
Nick Buckley. Mrs. Rice said she was the most amazing little liar and that she had invented the whole story of something going wrong with the brakes of her car. She said that her friend Mr. Lazarus told her there was nothing in it at all.
Ah, tiens, c'est intéressant ça. There is, of course, the type that tries to draw attention to itself by having marvellous escapes from death.
You don't think that...
That Mademoiselle Buckley is like that? No, I think not. You observe that we had great difficulty in convincing her of the danger in which she stands. But why should Mrs. Rice say that? What was her motive? Ah, it is interesting. The little facts that are curious, I like to see them appear. They point the way.
The way where?
You put your finger on the weak spot, my excellent Hastings. Where indeed? To hunt down a murderer after a crime has been committed, c'est tout simple. The murderer has, so to speak, signed his name by committing the crime. But here, there is no crime. And what is more, we do not want a crime.
But you must have some idea, some suspicion?
Nothing. On the face of it, no one seems to have any reason for desiring little Nick's death. The property, perhaps? And house passes to her cousin Charles Vice.
The worthy but dull solicitor in St. Lou.
Exactly, but does Mr. Vice really want a heavily mortgaged, dilapidated old house? We must speak to him, certainly, but the idea seems fantastic.
And everything else goes to Frederica Rice.
Mm, the bosom friend with her strange eyes and the air of a strayed Madonna. What is her concern in the business? She tells you that her friend is a liar. C'est gentil, ça. Why does she tell you that? Is she afraid of something that Nick might say? Did anyone tamper with the brakes of her car? And if so, who? And why should Mrs. Rice's admirer, Mr. Lazarus, the wealthy art dealer who is so knowledgeable about cars, support her accusation? And then there is Commander Challenger.
He's all right, I'm sure of that. A real pucker sob.
You have an extraordinary effect on me, Hastings. Hmm? You have so strongly the flare in the wrong direction that I am always tempted to go by it. Ah, well, I shall study the pucker, Commander Challenger.
You have awakened my doubts.
My dear Poirot, a man who has knocked about the world as I have...
Never learns. But let us take ourselves off to Mott's garage. Perhaps there we shall learn the truth about the brakes on Mademoiselle Nick's car.
It wasn't difficult to lure the proprietor into a discussion about what had befallen the brakes. He launched off into a highly technical account of what the trouble was, all of which was entirely beyond me, and certainly beyond Poirot. However, one thing became inescapably clear. The brakes had certainly been tampered with, and this could have led to a very serious accident.
So that is that. The little Nick was right, and the rich Mr. Lazarus, who knows so much about cars, was wrong. Ah, Hastings, my friend, all this is very curious.
Mm-hmm. So what do we do now?
We visit the post office and send off a telegram.
A telegram?
Yes, a telegram.
Poirot wrote out his telegram without vouchsafing any information as to its contents. Feeling that he wanted me to ask him what they were, I carefully refrained from doing so. There was dancing that evening at the Majestic. Nick Buckley was bursting with vivacity, dressed in floating scarlet chiffon that dragged on the floor. Frederica Rice was in white and moved with a languorous, weary grace that was as far removed from Nick's animation as could be.
She's very beautiful.
Young Nick?
No, her friend. Is she evil? Is she good? Is she merely unhappy? Ah, she is a mystery. But on the other hand, she is perhaps nothing at all. But I tell you, my friend, she is an allumeuse.
What do you mean?
You will feel it sooner or later. Remember my words.
Very mysterious. Why don't you go and have a word with her yourself?
I am anxious to have a word with you, madame, while your friend is dancing.
Oh, really? What about?
I do not know whether she has told you. An attempt was made on her life this morning.
What do you mean?
Mademoiselle Buckley was shot at in the garden of the hotel.
Did Nick tell you this?
No, madame. I happened to see it with my own eyes. Here is the bullet.
But that...
It was no fantasy of mademoiselle's. I can vouch for that. And several other very curious accidents have happened in the last few days. Perhaps you've not heard. You only arrived here quite recently, did you not?
Yes. I had been staying with friends at Tavistock.
At Tavistock? I wonder, madame, what were the names of the friends with whom you were staying?
Is there any reason I should tell you that?
Oh, 1,000 pardons, madame. I am most maladroit. But I myself have friends at Tavistock, and I thought that perhaps you might have met them there. Buchanan, that is their name.
No, I can't remember anyone called that, but don't let's talk about boring people in Tavistock. I want to know about Nick. Who shot at her, and why?
I do not know, as yet, but I shall find out. You may not be aware of the fact, madame, but I am a detective. Hercule Poirot is my name.
A very famous name.
Madame is too kind.
And what do you want me to do, Monsieur Poirot?
To watch over your friend. That is all.
I shall certainly do that.
Thank you, madame. I need not waste your valuable time any longer. Au revoir.
I think you're rather showing your...